Well, seeing as you're hearing my dulcet tones, that can only mean that I'm back in the radio studio here. It's catholicnews.org.uk. You're listening to our podcasts, and The Wanderer returns, which can only mean one thing. That's Dr. Harry Hagopian, and this is Middle East Analysis. يقولون سلام سلام ولا هنا سلام. You're listening to Middle East Analysis, a podcast series from the Catholic Bishops' Conference of England and Wales. Hello and welcome to another Middle East Analysis. It's April 2013, and I do, as I say, have Dr. Harry Hagopian, our international lawyer, ecumenical expert, well, pretty much expert on everything, but more prominently in this case, the Bishop's Consultant on the Middle East North Africa region. Harry, you've returned in one piece, which is always nice.
It is nice, and it's a pleasure to be in this small studio once more, James, and it'll be interesting to have a little chat. I assume we will be talking about the Middle East, North Africa.
You assume correctly. And I'm going to hone that in a bit. I know you've travelled, of course, on many occasions and very frequently in the year to the Middle East, North Africa region. I'd like to tailor this into a country you have been to many times, North Africa. Mm-hmm. We often talk about Libya and Egypt for fairly obvious reasons, or we have in the last few years.
Yes.
But I kind of want to go back now to the place it all began, to Tunisia.
Oh, so you're going back almost 3 years.
Going way back. We're going back to December 2010.
We're going back to the roots of what was called at the time the Arab Spring.
Well, that's it, because it's been troubling me in recent times as to whether the spring has sprung. And that's kind of the way I'm going to... That's where I'm going to go with this one.
Okay.
Harry. So let's take it right back to the very iconic Mohamed Bouazizi, 26-year-old, mm-hmm. who set himself on fire in the street, a street vendor, protesting against the state of the lack of rights, the lack of freedoms for the people. Fill us in a bit on why he did that. Fill us in a bit on whether it's led to anything concrete, or are we really all the way back to square one?
Mohamed Bouazizi, you sort of use very lofty principles there, James, when you talked about freedoms and rights. Yes, there is, of course, a lot of that across the Middle East, North Africa, as there is in almost every continent on this earth. But I think what really upset Mohamed Bouazizi in that little town called Sidi Bouzid in Tunisia is the economic situation rather than just fundamental rights in the abstract. That man was somebody who was struggling to make both ends meet. We know what, at least I know what that means sometimes. And in a sense, he was going through a rough economic time, as were many, many Tunisians who were not part and parcel of the elite, and he felt that his dignity was insulted by a policewoman who came and spoke with him as if he were an animal, a creature, not her equal. And he then, as you said, he set himself on fire. And that was the first impulse of what was called the Arab Spring at the time. It was called the Arab Spring because a lot of people had suggested that the Arab world, the Middle East and North Africa, had been hibernating for decades and decades, since before the Ottoman Empire, because four centuries of Ottoman Empire, where they ruled the region, followed by colonial powers taking over France, Britain, Italy, etc. And the Arab world, the Arab voice, the Arab reality was not anywhere to be heard of. So people were saying, Latin America, look at the things they're doing there. Africa, look at how it's trying to move forward. Forget Europe and the West. Where is the Middle East? Where is North Africa? Is it only to do with sand and oil, or is there something more than that? And of course, there is much more than that. The Middle East, North Africa is so vibrant with human resources, with thinking men and women, with active men and women, dynamic, ambitious, of different persuasions, of different backgrounds, of, dare I say, of different religions. But for some reason, it was always on mute. And suddenly, with this man self-immolating, then you suddenly found the impulse catching on. And we began with what was then known as the Arab Spring, started in Tunisia. The rest, you and I consider that history, given the number of times we've discussed those countries on our podcast. It went to Egypt, to Libya, to Yemen, now to Syria. And of course, other countries in one way or other are touched with by this impulse, but not in the same way.
Are you in any way surprised that it was Tunisia that was, if you like, literally the lit match that started this?
I was and I wasn't. Let me explain that. I was in the sense that Tunisia, in the imagination of most people, and certainly in the West, is a place like Mallorca or the Algarves or somewhere where you go on holiday, where it's got nice beaches, and it's supposed to be more secular, more open-minded, more prosperous than other countries in the region itself. So in that sense, yes, perhaps it was surprising that the initial impulse for what was then known as the Arab Spring began in Tunisia. But if you basically scratch the surface a little bit, then you would realize that much as there is this almost brochure-like image of Tunisia as a place with beautiful beaches where the Westerners could go drink, get drunk, have fun, but scratch that surface a little bit, there is a lot of economic deprivation, there is a lot of poverty. The human being and the dignity of the human being, or to use your term, the freedoms that human beings enjoyed in Tunisia, were as scarce as they were elsewhere. So what interests me is that revolutions, uprisings, outbursts of this nature, you can never actually academically, forensically decide where it's going to happen, when it's going to happen. It's almost spontaneous. What matters is what follows that impulse. And that is what happened in Tunisia with this young man who was selling vegetables, and he just got fed up with it. And of course, there have been other cases since then. He's not the only one who set himself on fire. There have been others, and it has become almost a form of protest against oppression, against economic poverty, and against lack of justice.
Now, you're right, I think, to draw that, if you like, juxtaposition. I mean, you could say the same somewhat about Morocco and Egypt, because they're the countries in North Africa that we only know because of the beaches and for our own pleasure in the summer, really.
Yeah.
But clearly, the being treated with a total lack of dignity, you're right to pull me back to his particular grievance at that time and the lack of equality mm-hmm. there. But it was a bigger picture, and the president fell quite quickly. And I think we started to think that maybe this was going to be domino effect, didn't we?
We did think it might be a domino effect. I remember at the time, and yours truly included on our podcast, but a lot of very seasoned experts and pundits and political analysts were all saying, oh, the MENA region is experiencing an Arab Spring. Lo and behold, in 6 months' time, the whole region is going to have a different face to it and a different reality to it. But I think that was a bit of an exaggeration for many reasons. When it first started in Tunisia, before it then moved on to other countries, and certainly when it reached Egypt, even the West was not ready for it. At the beginning, the West, France, United States, even our own government here in the UK, we're all sort of hoping that this is going to be another storm in a teacup, that yes, some people are going to be unhappy, but listen, the people, the natives of this region have been quiescent for so many decades and centuries. They're going to have a little bit of a spurt and then they settle down and things continue the way they would. Nobody thought that it would actually expand. But when they realized that it was expanding, that this was a much more popular movement that included men and women, and I stress men and women, and in some countries such as Egypt, Christians and Muslims, that they realized that this is bigger than just a storm in a teacup, then they began to take it seriously and try to factor that into their political calculations as to where the region would go. But the unpredictable way it started has been sustained in its unpredictability ever since 3 years back in Tunisia until today, when we see the horrendous scenes of what is happening, say, in Syria. But Would people have thought that this would be a quick domino effect? Quite a few people did, others didn't. But then again, the nature of the region is also something to take into consideration, James. A lot of people who don't understand the region well enough and yet consider themselves experts would say, oh, the MENA region, that's only an acronym of four letters, which encompasses a huge region. And it's all the same. What we understand about one country certainly should apply to another. Well, it doesn't. North Africa is entirely different kettle of fish from the Middle East. The Middle East itself is different. The Middle East is so different from the Gulf states, Oman, Saudi, the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain. Every country has its own particularity. Egypt is such a rich and ancient civilization compared to some other countries, Jordan, Lebanon, Palestine, Syria, which is basically colonially drawn borders that were put together and incidentally put together in such a mischievous way that they actually did not provide the space for the people to grow. There was no homogeneity in the way those borders were drawn. But I'm digressing. This you need to pick up with political intellectuals and thinkers, not with me.
Now, look, you've made a very good point there. Countries that are near neighbours are completely different from one another.
Indeed.
And we did think that, that there would be something of a domino effect. But what I want to go back to, Tunisia, solely Tunisia, let's look at that. You mentioned the economic situation and the frustrations at that time. I don't want this to be controversial, but it's part of the problem that all of us thought, oh, look, a reimagining, the people having their say and things actually coming to the fore, rights being upheld and so forth. Is it actually a sort of microcosm for a wider depressing picture that people stand up, things appear to change, new rulers promise new constitutions and a better reality for the people, but actually we'll just wait till they calm down a bit and then we'll get our iron grip back on it?
Well, that's a very good point you make, James, because within that comment you made or remark, there's so many different variables that one could touch upon. One is, unfortunately, the supercilious arrogance of the West in thinking that they understand the region, and therefore there is an attitude by the West that eventually those natives will calm down. It's just a question of how do we deal with them and how do we manage the region long enough for things to settle down so that we could go back to pursuing our own vested interests. I mean, if our listeners are interested in that angle or that direction of thought, then one person who is absolutely a giant, a titan in this, is Professor Noam Chomsky. He would have a lot to say about the West and how the West has manipulated the Middle East, North Africa region. Another person who used to do it brilliantly well is a dear person who's now dead, Professor Edward Said. Now, that's one way of looking at it. Another way of looking at it is that when we in the West, who take the French Revolution, take the American Revolution, take our own problems in this country, it has taken decades and decades in the past until we've managed to get it together, until we've got what we now would call a fair sense or a fair stab at democracy, at a rule of governance that basically also appreciates the human being and the dignity of the human being. It didn't happen overnight. It didn't happen in 2 years. It didn't happen in 3 years. So it is a revolution between inverted commas that is ongoing, that's going to have its ups and downs. But I think this time what we're witnessing in the Middle East, North Africa, is that it's shaken off the dust enough for it not to fall back in the same way that it was before, and therefore we go back to what is the status quo ante and say, oh, okay, they've had 3-4 years of difficult uprisings, now things have gone back to where they were before. I think things will not go back to where they were before. Things will change. That doesn't necessarily mean that things will immediately change for the better. I think the whole region is experimenting with stuff. Take Egypt, take Tunisia, take Libya, take all those countries, take Yemen. You had dictatorships and you had dictators who were running things with an iron fist. Now, you see in a lot of countries, there is a strong wave of Islamism. And while Islam and Islamism, political Islam, the Muslim Brotherhood, the more Salafist members or parties, were when they were oppressed, repressed, in prison under those secular dictatorships, they were the people that were the hope for the future. Now that they are the ones who are governing, they are the ones who are now running the show, Egypt being an example, the other countries to some extent, Tunis is the example as well with the government and parliament, you are realizing that even they're making mistakes, they're getting it quite wrong. But what has happened, it has excited a certain kind of popular reaction, outspokenness, expression that would be very difficult to contain again. Let me use my image, which you and I have used in the past, and you've smiled when I've said it. I believe that we're going through a very difficult period in the Middle East, North Africa. This is not a time to rejoice. This is a time to go through the labor pains of something that is being born with the hope that it's not going to be stillborn, that it's going to be something that is going to be good for the future of the peoples of the region, the indigenous peoples, not the people from Russia to America who are controlling the fate of this region. However, one thing I'm sure of is that once the genie is out of the bottle, you can't put the genie back in the same bottle.
Now, as a father of five, I have to say to you that I have, and it's a very luxurious position, witnessed the labour pains and not felt them. And that's kind of what we're doing here, isn't it?
I mean, it's
quite a luxurious position for us to be in, saying, oh, let's just see how it shakes down.
Well, it is a luxurious position, although to be honest with you, that is where I differ with a lot of our experts and pundits who basically sit there and they do armchair analysis. I feel for the region because I know the region well enough. I know the people of the region. I know the riches that this region has, different kinds of riches in different kinds of parts of the region. And when you see what's happening, when you see how Tunisia, where it all started and which was in a sense the hope for or the model for the rest of the region, go through those painful contractions politically, in terms of parliament, in terms of executive, in terms of judiciary, in terms of who runs what. Does the Muslim Brotherhood and do the Islamists run the show? Can they run the show? And if they do, what does that say about women's rights in the whole region? What does it say about minorities' rights? You look at what's happening in Egypt, for instance, where you see a president who hails straight from the Muslim Brotherhood, who, when he was in prison, and when he was in the opposition, he was promising all sorts of good things for the Egyptians. Now that he's in the presidential residence, he's the one who's exercising oppression. He's the one who's clamping down on journalists. The John Stewart of the Arab world is in Egypt, Bassem Youssef. He has a program which is absolutely hugely interesting satire program on the politics of Egypt. He's been summoned to the police station because he's exceeding his limits. You look at what's happening in Yemen with the uncertainties. An old president supposedly left power. His vice took over from him. And yet you can see the divisions between the south of Yemen in Aden, between the Houthi tribe in the north, and all the manipulations happening there. You look at Libya. Benghazi and Tripoli are two worlds apart. They're trying to get their act together. They're sitting on barrels and barrels of oil, so it matters to the West, incidentally. And then you've got Syria, where you see planes, Scud missiles, TNT bombs, cluster bombs being thrown on demonstrators and rebel fighters, and the world is not saying anything. In return, you can see excesses and a narrow, pervanimous form of ideology beginning to draw up within some ranks of the opposition because they are feeling a little bit abandoned. And what do we do with that? So in a sense, your initial question, and I remember, and I'm sure our listeners would remember too, you hinted at it in our last podcast as well. Has the Arab Spring sprung? I don't think the Arab Spring has sprung, but the Arab Spring has still a lot of spring left in it.
Do you know what? You've quite rightly, I think, gone from Tunisia to expand it across the region. Fascinating and very well done. But just to draw this one to a close for me.
Yes.
Where are we at with Tunisia now?
Well, there are two things that happened in Tunisia, interestingly enough, very recently. One was a conference that was organized by the Center for the Study of Islam and Democracy. And you had all sorts of political people who came and talk. It's supposed to be about Islam and democracy. Most of the people who spoke were politicians. But it gave you an idea, a flavor of where these people are going. And you realize that there is something in the air. But it's still indistinct. It's still unsure which way it's going. It's still a battle between the Islamists who now have tasted power and are not ready to relinquish it again, and those secularists, leftists in a Tunisian context, who are defending the fundamental freedoms and the dignity of man, as the left has done even in our own Western culture or in the Middle Eastern culture. I mean, a lot of intellectual thinkers in the Middle East would hate from that political background anyway. Then there was another incident that took place simultaneously, parallel to this conference I talked to you about, and that's the World Social Movement, which is a forum of all peoples from all parts of the world coming together as a popular manifestation of issues. So they were discussing the Palestinian issue, they were discussing the MENA uprisings, they were discussing rights, etc. And interestingly enough, it's viewed as an anti-Davos kind of establishment movement, because Davos is very much the rich, the capitalist world, the establishment, and this is more the grassroots people. And interestingly enough, for the first time ever, the World Social Movement took place in an Arab country, in this case Tunisia. So what I'm trying to say is that unlike many people who either would say, oh, we're in the flush of a wonderful time in the MENA region, or those who would say, shall we write the obituary for the Arab Spring, so-called, because we tried it for 3 years and it didn't work. Look at what's happened. It's messed things up more than they were when at least we had some order, because we knew that there was that man up there who was keeping everything under the lid. I would say that we're somewhere in the middle of all that, and I would pray that as we move forward, as we dabble with all forms of governance, with all the issues that have been kept under the radar for so many, 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 many long years, will eventually lead the region from Tunisia to Egypt, to Libya, to Yemen, certainly to Syria. I keep thinking and I shudder every time I think of what the Syrian men and women and children are suffering, and the impact that suffering is having on Lebanon, on Jordan, on Turkey, on other countries, as well as Iraq, let's not forget. In fact, the whole region. And let me finish off with one point before you get too impatient with me, James. Interestingly enough, in all of this, you said domino effect, but there was no domino effect, because they didn't, all the leaders didn't just catapult and leave power. That is true. But the reason is that the leaders were caught by surprise at the beginning, but they learned fast enough to know how to fight back. Look what's happening in Syria, but interestingly, what's also happening in the Gulf states. They learned it and they know how to firewall their own power bases, while at the same time trying to move or inch forward a bit to meet somehow some of the demands of the people. It's a long process.
They've learned how to do the dance on the rhetoric a bit internationally, haven't they, as well?
Absolutely.
Right, Harry. That's Dr. Harry Hagopian, at Harry Hagopian on Twitter. I've got to pop that in there. You're listening to Middle East Analysis on catholicnews.org.uk. Harry, it is that time. I'm going to give you a final thought. I'm going to give you 150 seconds to do this. This is positive. This is a good news story, if you like. Let's talk awards, Harry.
Let's talk awards, James. And yes, 150 seconds. I'm just going to draw people's attention, our listeners, to two key awards that took place recently. One was the award of the Templeton Prize to Archbishop Desmond Tutu in South Africa. Archbishop Desmond Tutu does not need an introduction. He's an icon who fought against South African apartheid. And this Templeton Prize is from a foundation which is based in the United States, and it appreciated his spiritual input and his help in liberating the shackles of oppression under apartheid in South Africa. So Desmond Tutu, a wonderful man. If ever there was a Christian, he's one of them. The other one, I think, is the Sheikh Zayed Book Award, which actually is probably the most prestigious, and if not the most, then one of the most prestigious book awards for the Arab world, based in the United Arab Emirates in Abu Dhabi. And they have an annual award where they give this to the best thinkers, writers, philosophers of the Arab world who have published books in Arabic. And this year, the top prize for the Sheikh Zayed Book Award was to Dr. Elizabeth Kassab from Lebanon. A friend of the show, and this is what I was going to say. She scooped this award under the Development of Nations category for her book, A Critique of Contemporary Arab Thought, which was initially published by Columbia University in English and then translated into Arabic in Lebanon. And, as you said, a friend of the show, coming from Lebanon, what does this prove? It's not only that Elizabeth Kassab is a very good thinker and a good writer, it is that the Arab world is full of Elizabeth Kassabs if only we remove the manacles and the handcuffs that put these people in those boxes and give them the space to talk. So good luck to Elizabeth, good luck to Archbishop Desmond Tutu, and good luck to everybody who wants to see their souls liberated from their bodies in a positive way.
Can't say fairer than that. That's Dr. Harry Hagopian, our consultant on the Middle East North Africa region, with another Middle East analysis there. You can catch us on Twitter at CatholicEW. You can catch Harry on Twitter at Harry Hagopian. That's two plugs, Harry. I hope you appreciate that. Otherwise, do keep checking this space, catholicnews.org.uk. We're in the podcast section there, and we'll be back very soon to discuss the myriad of things that I now have on my list when we do our next Middle East analysis.